We begin today's science show with the voice of one of the smartest guys of the 20th century.
When I was young, of course, and could only dream maybe someday of being more accomplished and important in the world, I used to have fun by noticing little things and trying to see if I could work them out. Any old kind of thing, like I'd see a stream of water coming out of a faucet that running very smooth, and it would get narrower as it ran down. And I had just learned a little math, and I wondered if I could find a formula for how it gets narrow as it goes down. And it turned out very easy to do, but I get a kick out of that, and I kept working all the time on figuring out equations, different shaped curves. For instance, I had a toaster. You had to pull out a lever in order to make the bread turn over, and the lever was connected in a funny way, so when you pulled it out, it had a strange motion, and I tried to figure out the equation for that. I didn't succeed. That was too complicated. But when you learn new things, you try to play with it and try to fiddle around. And they fiddle around ever since.
You know, he worked out what the universe is made of. His name a little later. We begin with that big puzzle. This is Professor Frank Werthwein, who does research at CERN in Switzerland. Why are we so excited by the Higgs boson when few have a clue what it is?
It has a lot to do with it having been looked for so long, and then Letterman having given it a very corny name. That certainly hasn't hurt.
The goddamn particle, which became the God particle, Leon Lederman.
Exactly. And that makes people wonder, so what is that about? And then more recently, when people saw the massive amount of technological effort and human effort that goes into this, it's just fascinating to do such an enormous enterprise for something so esoteric and elusive.
But it's not esoteric in the sense that if you understand the universe and how it works, if you understand protons and electrons and the nucleus, then that tells you something about the real world and how exciting it is and how scientists in the last century have revealed it. You know, this is a really imaginative quest, is it not?
Yeah, and I think that it goes back to fundamental human instinct of wanting of where did we come from? What is our world? What is it made out of? And what's the universe? And a sense of wanting to know your own cosmology. How did it all begin? And that sort of thing is something that just inspires humanity.
Well, now we've found the Higgs boson. What next?
I think it is a closure to some degree because it closes a chapter that started sometime around the 60s. So I look at it as a closure of a 50-year story on understanding the normal stuff that things are made out of. And now the next big question is, what's the universe made out of? What else is in there? And within the last 10, 20 years, we almost went through a Copernican revolution of suddenly we realize, gee, this makes up only 5% or 4.5% of the universe. So what is all this other stuff? And so the big next thing in my mind is really, what's dark matter? What is dark energy? What's the rest of the universe, the other 95% made out of? As we close one chapter, a whole new set of questions begin.
Will you be able to use the apparatus at CERN to find out the answers, or will you need even bigger accelerators, apparatus, and so on?
I think the hope is that the accelerator at CERN will be sufficient to see the first glimpse of what is there to be understood. It's not guaranteed. With the Higgs, we had a very concrete understanding of where to look. There was a range, and we were shrinking that range over time. With dark matter, we don't have that. We don't have an idea of what it's all made out of and where it comes from and what its physics is, what its science is. So it's a lot harder to say, will this particular instrument make the revolution, or will it require the next instrument?
Talk about the next instrument. The one you've got is 27 kilometers long. How big does the next one have to be, and can we afford it?
That's actually an interesting question. Of course we can afford it if it becomes a priority. We're not talking trillions of dollars or something like this. We're talking billions, but billions, there's lots we afford for billions of dollars. So that's really a matter of societal priorities. How large it will be, there is a very nice map that people have started drawing. And if you look at the Geneva geography, there is a mountain which is the Célève, And right now, people are talking to build this accelerator around this mountain. I think the circumference is something in the neighborhood of getting close to 100 kilometers.
100 kilometers, well, that'll take some doing. And what about your own particular role in this quest?
My contribution to the experiment has been in large-scale distributed computing. My group and colleagues I work with, we've come up with the means to build a globally distributed infrastructure that it can then be used to ship the data around that comes out of the detectors, analyze it, make sure that anybody who is a member of the experiment has access to all the data, irrespective of where it is located and that sort of thing.
An apparatus 100 kilometers long to find a thingy you can't see or picture? Well, that was Professor Frank Wirthwein, once of Heidelberg, now working at CERN and the University of California, San Diego. Now that voice, that genius, once more.
For example, I invented some way of doing problems in physics or quantum electrodynamics and made some diagrams that helped to make the analysis. I was on a floor in a rooming house I was in my pajamas. I'd been working on a floor in my pajamas many weeks, you know, fooling around. But I got these funny diagrams after a while and found they were useful. They helped me to find the equations easier. So I thought of the possibility that it might be useful for other people. And I thought it would really look funny, these funny diagrams I'm making, if they appear someday in the physical review, because they looked so odd to me. And I remember sitting there thinking how funny that would be if it ever happened, ha ha. Well, it turned out, in fact, that they were useful, and they do appear in the physical review, and I can now look at them and see other people making them and smile to myself. They do look funny to me, as they did then. Not as funny, because I've seen so many of them, but I get the same kick out of it. That was a little fantasy when I was a kid. Not a kid, I was a college professor already at Cornell. But the idea was that I was still playing just like I was always been playing, and the secret of my happiness in life, or the major part of it, is to have discovered a way to entertain myself that other people consider important and they pay me to do. I do exactly what I want and I get paid. Well, they might consider it serious, but the secret is...
better that they do.
The secret is I'm having a very good time.
The brilliant Richard Feynman. His name will recur as we go in this science show on the Nuclear Zoo. Now, you may not follow all the twists of what you're about to hear, but rest assured, it's part of this next Copernican revolution in physics Frank mentioned before. I bring you the amplituhedron through Joel Werner in New York.
The continual narrative of progress in theoretical physics is that you're always studying some object that knows vastly more about what's going on than you do. You know, we get to wander around and ask this object question. It's like a seer, right? Now, asking it questions means practically you do some calculation and you see what the outcome of the calculation is. And very often there's a surprise. It doesn't behave quite the way you expect it. So those surprises accumulate and they start telling you about maybe there's a different way of thinking about what's going on.
An object that knows more about the universe than the people studying it? Like a lot of things in quantum physics, explaining the ins and outs of this strange multifaceted jewel, the amplituhedron, is confusingly counterintuitive. So I'm here to speak with one of the world's leading theoretical physicists, Nima Arkani Hamed. Nima's going to try to explain exactly what this object is, but to get there, we need to work from the bottom up. From the very bottom up.
Everything that we see in the world around us is made of atoms, and atoms have substructure. Atoms have an electron that whizzes around protons and neutrons, and we looked inside protons and neutrons, and we see they have substructure. They're made out of things called quarks that are permanently held together inside protons and neutrons by gluons.
The story begins in the subatomic world of particle physics, the science that investigates elementary particles, the very building blocks of the universe.
We seem to have a small zoo of elementary particles. It isn't a huge number of them, by the way, but it's not one or two. There's electrons, protons and neutrons made out of quarks called up and down quarks that are held together by gluons. Muons or taus. Maybe most people haven't heard of neutrinos. Most people haven't heard of the strange quark or the charm quark or the bottom quark or the top quark. These things were all invented in the 70s, so you should not blame my generation of people for the trippy quality to it.
Trippy, sure, but these elementary particles are important. And not just because they're what everything's made of. They also provide the best clues we have about the laws that govern how the universe works.
We're interested in the fundamental laws. And the importance of the particles is that the particles carry the most direct representation of what the underlying laws are. So the fact that there's a little zoo of these particles with a bunch of funny names, that's not the important part. The important part is that this small zoo is actually described by one extremely simple and coherent set of laws. And furthermore, that all of the interactions we see, everything we see in the world around us, everything boils down to one basic type of interaction between these elementary particles. And that's an interaction involving three of them meeting at a point. It's a fairly astonishing thing.
If the collision of particles contains all the information we need to understand the universe, then understanding particle collisions is really important. But the physics that describes these collisions is immensely complex. So what physicists try to do is they try to simplify this complexity.
Thank you so much, Feynman. Here's your Nobel Prize.
Over 60 years ago, Richard Feynman developed what became known as Feynman diagrams. They were really the first way we had to try to understand what happens when particles collide. The diagrams are really just highly stylized doodling. A series of icons represent the particles, the forces, the energies, the directions, everything you need to describe a particle collision. So you just imagine the parameters for the collision you want to describe.
You know, if I send in two electrons, send in two particles, they're coming in one direction,
in, bang into each other, and they
bang into each other somehow, and they go out.
The direction.
They produce a third one.
Fourth one
comes in from the outside and hits them.
If I send in two electrons, they bang into each other somehow, produce a third one. Fourth one, they go out.
And then you simply draw every possible outcome of the collision.
You draw these pictures, as Feynman taught us how to do, his famous diagrams, and you've got to just add up every possible way that it can happen, and that, in the end, gives you the correct quantum mechanical description for what we call scattering amplitudes.
A scattering amplitude is the quantum description for the outcome of a particle collision. Particle physics isn't deterministic. We can never know exactly what will happen. But if we imagine everything that could possibly happen, we'll get a pretty good idea about what's going on. It's a beautifully intuitive idea that you can calculate the probability that something might happen by drawing every possible outcome that ever could happen. Drawing the diagrams for a situation where two particles go into the collision and two particles leave the collision is relatively easy. But as soon as you need to understand more complex collisions,
people started needing to do the calculation where two particles go in, three particles go out. Two particles go in, four particles go out. But already two in and three out. The final answer, if you follow the recipe that Feynman and his friends taught us, which ultimately boils down to just describing what's going on in pictures in space and time, the final answer is something like 50 pages of algebra. It's a horrendous mess, absolutely horrendous mess. Physics does very often have a way of rewarding morally good behavior, or at least intellectually morally good behavior. Because there were people who had to figure out how to deal with these 50 pages, and they had to figure out some way of doing it, because the 50 pages was when 2 goes to 3. When 2 goes to 4, it was, you know, massive number. I mean, it was just ridiculous. It started getting completely out of control.
And just so you know, algebra homework never gets any better.
Well, yeah, someone's got to do it. It's too bad. The experimentalists need the answers. Someone's got to go do this very difficult calculation. That's 50 pages, big pain in the butt.
And for a while, that was that.
Not every question has a simple answer. There are just things in the world that are complicated. The fact that it looked like 50 pages of algebra is totally reasonable. You look, this is just something complicated. Look, it's just a complicated function. If I smash these two tables together, I'm not going to come up with a beautiful formula that tells me what's going to happen when the legs and the other pieces start coming out. It's not obvious ahead of time.
But it's the job of theoretical physicists to look beyond the chaos. Even though a lot of what they do seems complicated, they're actually always looking for simple answers to the complex problems. So, the hunt was on for a simpler way to describe what happens when two particles collide. A simpler way, that is, than drawing out every possible outcome.
Feynman's way of thinking about things organizes the complicated scattering process as a series of clunks, as a series of one thing bangs into another, bangs into another, bangs into another in every possible way. You add up all the possible ways it could happen, and that's correct. There's nothing wrong about it. But the amazing thing is that that way of thinking about things misleads you into thinking that the final answer is horrendously complicated, when in fact it isn't horrendously complicated. Progress in our business always works essentially incrementally. And every now and then, you know, someone makes a bit of a jump that's bigger than what came before, and you immediately converge around what that idea was, and you explore its vicinity and see how much further it can take you. And so a group of people doing some heroic work in the 1980s started figuring out, using every trick in the book, how to simplify these calculations. They took the 50 pages and they turned it into 8 pages. Right? So that was already pretty amazing. They wrote a paper. They were like, this is incredible. We got it down to 8 pages. And people were really impressed. But they had a sneaking suspicion that they could do better. They did. They collapsed those 50 pages to 1 term. I mean, it fits on half an inch on a page, or maybe an inch if you write big like I do. So this is completely insane, right? But somehow, this picture of the world that Feynman gave us led us to suspect the answer was 50 complicated, impossible pages, and yet the final answer could fit on half a lot.
But wait a minute, what does any of this have to do with a mysterious multidimensional jewel? Well, this is where Nima comes in. About 6 years ago, he started to get interested in these calculations that describe scattering amplitudes, or the quantum outcome of particle collisions. And when Nima came on the scene, he recognized something pretty strange.
The whole scattering amplitude could be represented as the volume of something.
Nima realized that each function in the super simplified equation that describes what happens when two particles collide also describes something else, the volume of an object. One equation that explains two very different things. No matter what the specific nature of the particle collision, how many particles go in, how much energy is involved, how many new particles might be created, everything about it can always be described by calculating the volume of this strange object, the amplitudehedron.
The interesting thing is how elementary this object is. I mean, these functions, when they come out, when you actually finish calculating all of them, they're not simple-looking things. They're big, complicated, messy expressions. They have all this richness and complexity to them, which is reflecting what's happening with things banging into each other in space and time. The remarkable thing is that all that complexity is secretly telling you about the volume of a very simple object, not in space-time, but in another space. Okay, and that's the sort of thing we like to see in physics.
An important point to emphasize here is that this object, the amplitudehedron, isn't describing the actual physical shape of a particle collision. It has nothing to do with whatever the explosion looks like. Instead, all the maths, all the pages and pages of algebra that provide the quantum description of a particle collision also happen to be the exact same maths that calculates the volume of this jewel-like object, the amplitudehedron. One equation that explains two very different things. You might be wondering how Nima figured all this out. I mean, it just seems so unlikely. Well, here's the trick. Physicists look for simplicity in chaos. It's when these super complicated calculations unexpectedly become simpler that they realize there must be something else going on. Something deeper and more fundamental to the universe.
You tend to know there's something going on. You know there's something going on because calculations come out much simpler than you expected, or something that should have been a big number turns out to be zero. Something surprises you. And you have to convince yourself it's not a trick or an accident, which often it is. But if it's not a trick or an accident, then you think there's something generating it. There's a structure there. For example, in this particular example, the point of entry into thinking about all of this was examining these formulas that calculated scattering amplitudes, right? So we're staring at them. Each formula, you know, it's a sum of like 20 terms, let's say. You have 20 terms, and each term is some particular expression. There are some remarkable things happening when you add them together. There's all kinds of amazing cancellations that are taking place between them and so on. So you know each term is telling you something, okay? It's coming from some other world, right? And you know that it's there, because otherwise all of these miracles wouldn't be happening. But you have to figure out how to reorient your head in the world of ideas in order to see what this thing really is. And it became increasingly clear there was a stunning mathematical structure. I mean, it's a very surprising connection. It's one of many things that hints that there's a way of thinking about space-time physics in a way that associates it with very different kind of mathematical objects.
And that's the deeper implication here. The amplitudehedron might just turn out to be a quirk of mathematics and nothing more. I mean, to date, it's only been proven on a theoretical model, and everyone, even the people working on it, admit that it's very early days in terms of how well we understand it. But there's one line of thought that suggests this strange object might challenge the very notion that space and time are fundamental aspects of the universe. There's a growing belief in theoretical physics that the notion of space-time doesn't exist, and that the amplitudehedron might be a way of explaining this mind-blowing anomaly.
99% of theoretical physicists on the planet will tell you space-time doesn't exist. This would take a while to explain, but really deep conceptual paradoxes involving quantum mechanics and gravity, not just space-time, but the fluctuations of space-time that we think of as gravity. And we know already space-time doesn't exist, and we've known for decades that space-time doesn't exist. Okay. Now, what does that mean? Of course, space-time exists in every practical sense. There is space, there is time. You're sitting there, I'm sitting here. We're not smashing into each other. Time obviously exists. I think, I forget who it was who said that time exists so that everything doesn't happen at once. Okay, so it's possible to have ordinary experience of the physical world without realizing these deeper things about it that are true. So when we say that we suspect space-time doesn't exist, it means that we think that space and time somehow aren't part of the final, ultimate correct formulation of physics, but are somehow going to emerge as some approximate description of what's going on when we look at things in a sufficiently coarse-grained way. Now, the kind of situations where we expect this coarse-graining to be a very bad approximation involve really extreme things. The universe is expanding. If we go back to earlier and earlier in time, we expect there's some time at which the universe becomes so curved that the whole notion of space and time is starting to break down. We often colloquially refer to it as the Big Bang singularity, for example. That's a place where our notions of space and time are just breaking down and we need to replace it with something else.
And that something else might turn out to be geometry. It just so happens that even though the particle collisions described by the amplitudehedron occur in space-time, the object itself exists outside it, in a purely mathematical space. Space-time is a property of the universe that emerges from the mathematics of geometry.
So despite the fact that the usual picture of space-time and the usual rules of quantum mechanics make no appearance in the definition of the amplitudehedron, and something else does, some other very simple geometry does, this simple geometry has as a consequence those properties that are needed in order to see the result as coming from space-time and being compatible with the principles of quantum mechanics. And that's what I had wanted to see when I got into this business 6 years ago.
Dr. Nima Arkani-Hamed with Joel Werner in New York. The Science Show, in which we abolished space-time. Today will just continue forever, especially in politics. The Science Show on RN. So let's chuck a physical Huey and go to FameLab, the finals in Fremantle. Our PhD, Francis Torres. No, let me introduce him properly.
Francis Torres from the University of Western Australia.
Once upon a time, in a land far, far away, Curiosity landed on Mars, marking one of the great moments in human history. In fact, my research may play a part, maybe. I've worked on improving existing technologies for space exploration, as well as for finding hidden minerals and extra water sources for Australia. And the idea is to connect a sensor to a new type of amplifier, so that we can look deeper underground and try and find harder-to-find targets. To help see this, imagine you're at the beach and you're using a metal detector and there's a gold ring in the sand. If it's too deep, you won't find it. unless you stick one of my amplifiers to the sensor, and then a small signal coming from the ring is amplified, and boom, you find it, and lunch is on you. I have focused on the heart of this amplifier device, which is a very small mirror. And in order for this to work, you need to harness an interaction between the motion of the mirror and laser light. It helps to think of it as two dancing partners, laser light and mirror motion. And with the correct steps, it's possible to amplify the motion of the mirror. But it requires another thing. The mirror has to have high quality. And let me illustrate what that is. Imagine a giant bell and a big, hairy, ugly caveman with a stick, and then bong, and it rings for millions of years. It rings longest for high quality. So, just like a bell rings, my mirrors, excited by laser light, vibrate, and it allows for strong amplification. With a collaboration of Taiwan, France, Queensland, and Perth, we've managed to make those special mirrors which not only meet the requirements for my applications, they also outperform similar prototypes from around the world. And I believe that my research will be used to increase the wealth in Australia by finding hidden mineral deposits as well as extra water resources that we'll need. But personally, me, Francis, I really want to see Mars rovers making groundbreaking discoveries and using a device with my name on it, a framplifier.
Francis Torres at the University of Western Australia. More on FameLab, the international finals next week. The Science Show on RN. Well, I'm in the centrifuge room at the University of Western Australia with Mark Cassidy, who previously won one of the Prime Minister's Science Prizes. It's great to see you again. But the noises of the centrifuge, is it slowing down at the moment?
Yes, Robin, it's slowing down. We were at 200 G, so 200 times that of Earth's gravity, spinning at 220 kilometres an hour, about 200 kilograms of soil. So we've turned the machine off and it's slowing down to a halt, and we'll be able to go in and have a look at the soil inside.
So one of these big boxes looks like a very large hamper.
But we often get a lot of offshore samples, so we can get sands from the Northwest Shelf, or we can get big grab samples of very soft muds and clays, for instance. We get delivered soils from all around the world. We've done a lot of projects for West Africa, off Angola, and soils that have been collected from over 3,000 metres water depth.
And so you spend your day slinging 200 kilos of soil round in very fast circles.
Indeed. I have a three-year-old son, Benjamin. He went off this morning to play in his sandpit, and he says to me that I'm going to play in my sandpit, Dad. Have a good time.
So you're talking, in fact, about platforms. If there's mining or drilling out in the ocean, and you've got one of these huge platforms, which presumably you tow out from somewhere, and its legs go down, and you've got to make sure the whole system's stable.
Absolutely. One of them's called a mobile drilling platform, and that's right. They float with their hull in the water, their legs up above the waterline. When they get the site, they can drop those legs down to the seabed and then jack the hull up off the water, which pushes these very large 20-metre diameter footings into the seabed. That can be quite an easy operation if you've got increasing strengths and you get a nice, easy installation. But you can get scenarios in Australia and around Asia where you get strong soil over soft soil. If you're in that scenario, you can be being held up in this strong soil, and you don't want that to give way and push through into the softer soil.
So presumably by putting the soil you've got here under various stresses, you can predict how sloshy it's going to be in the end.
Well, absolutely, and that's our main aim, to use physical observations to underpin our analytical models. So we measure the loads and look at when they fail, we observe the failure mechanisms, and then we let that enlighten our analytical models, which engineers can then use in their daily design.
Kelvin's now opening the centrifuge room. I go inside and... This huge old protective wall is opening up. This monster. Oh, it's a bit like the inside of the TARDIS. This great... Well, you describe it. What's in there?
Well, this is just a kaolin clay, which we're preparing a sample for. It's in a large box, which is attached to a 3.6 metre diameter, what we call a beam centrifuge. So when it spins around, the box, which is now in a horizontal position, will spin out and be vertical. We will attach to this box eventually some actuators. And what these tests are for is we're actually going to drop little what look like darts that you'd use in a pub darts competition. These are called torpedo anchors. And what they're interested in doing is in very deep water, say 2,000 or 3,000 metres, it's just dropping these darts into the seabed. So what we're interested in is how far will they go in? And once they're in, how much strength will they have? Because we want to know that strength and that capacity so we can tell the engineers whether they can hold a floating system through a mooring line.
How big are those platforms?
They're absolutely enormous. I mean, you might have heard that there's a new floating liquefied natural gas plant being built on a ship, which is going to be moored off the coast of Western Australia. That's called the Prelude Development, and it's going to actually be 488 metres long, 74 metres wide, weighing 600,000 tonnes, and that's five aircraft carriers in weight.
Five aircraft carriers? I mean, that's gigantic, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's very big scale, and these are very large investments for the companies and for the country, for Australia. These are the largest infrastructure projects that are occurring at the moment in Australia.
Of course, you don't want something like that suddenly going out to sea, and after, what, 6 months or a year, it slowly sidles sideways as one of the legs sinks.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, that's the main aim of our centre, is to be able to safely design this type of infrastructure. So large floating vessels moored, or, as you say, fixed platforms which have legs all the way to the seabed. So what we're trying to do is make safer designs so that these things don't fail in our very large tropical cyclones that we get here in Australia.
Mm. Has that happened much? Have you had platforms sink down?
Well, you might remember Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf of Mexico. We remember the levees breaking in New Orleans, but in the Gulf of Mexico, a lot of floating platforms, the mooring lines broke. A lot of fixed platforms, the legs broke as well, and that caused many billions of dollars of damage. One of the main differences we have here in Australia is that we try to operate our platforms through these type of cyclones. It's only in very, very harsh conditions would they evacuate. So what we need to do is have very, very robust designs. In the Gulf of Mexico, they actually take people off the platforms when they see a large cyclone coming through.
Yes, I bet they do. Where are these platforms made, the ones we have?
Throughout Asia, the Prelude has actually just come out of a shipyard in Korea. I and a lot of my colleagues actually work in Singapore a lot with shipbuilders there. But a lot of the design is done here in Australia, but it's very much an international industry, and people are looking for competitive advantage in this area all around the world.
And they're actually towed all that way from Singapore?
Absolutely, yeah, on the back of a barge, or they get towed out and then installed here in Australia.
Tell me, if you were to close the door and the centrifuge were to be activated, would I be splattered up against the wall?
We wouldn't want to do that to the ABC, Robin, and to all your avid fans. No, we have safety attachments. We can't spin the centrifuge until it's been locked, both from the inside and the outside, and the technicians, who we have full-time working on this, ensure that there's no one left inside. But you'll probably see some of the marks. We do occasionally have little pieces of model
come off
and make some adjustments to our protective wall.
Yeah, smashing through the concrete is an incredibly powerful thing. Finally, do you get very many surprises when you get a soil turn up and you think, oh, yeah, know all about that? Does it suddenly behave strangely and you think, ooh?
Absolutely. It's both the challenge for us and the excitement of science in this area, that all the soils are different and every site has a different type of soil, and we need to understand the specific soil of that site. And that's really the genesis of why we have a very strong geotechnics group here in Western Australia, was when they went to build the first platform called the Rankin platform here, they got that sort of surprise. They went to hit these very long, slender piles, steel piles, to hold up the platform, and after a few hits, they just disappeared into the seabed. And that's because we have very carbonate material here, been akin to building on eggshells, and it can crush under pressure. What happened was it crushed and moved away from the pile and they just disappeared. So we hope not to have too many surprises in the future, that's for sure.
Thanks very much. It's good to see you again. I'll leave you to your sandpit.
Thanks very much, Robin.
Mark Cassidy, who's a laureate fellow in his sandpit at the Australian Research Council Centre of Excellence, University of Western Australia. So, as we hear week after week, Australia has a superb record in ideas for innovation. The problem is in realising them in the marketplace. Professor Andreas Forres has a new way of letting us look at your inner organs moving around in your body so that they may be treated effectively. He's from Monash.
So we have a fully operating prototype. This prototype works on small animals, not on humans. But that prototype has been operational for about 6 months now, and it works perfectly. It works at least as well as how we hoped. And unlike compounds, unlike, you know, in pharmacy, the translation from a mouse to a human is much more straightforward. If the imaging works for a mouse, in fact, it's easier to work for a human. So between us and there is some hard work and some money.
So you take your mouse. Does the mouse have to stay still or what?
No, well, the great thing is because we are imaging motion directly, if the mouse moves, then that's no problem. It's something that we can easily see and easily compensate for. This is one of the problems with, for example, imaging the lung. Typically, you're asked to take a deep breath in, hold, and a CT or some other scan is performed. And to me, that's akin to when asked to look at the engine of your car, your mechanic asking you to turn it off so he can take a photo of it. This thing is designed to move. In fact, if it doesn't move, that's really the end. So motion is key in so much of biology. So the patient can move, the patient's meant to move, and the patient breathes throughout the scan.
What's different about this that, for instance, ultrasound or some similar kind of imaging system couldn't do?
Ultrasound doesn't really work very well on the lung. MRI does not really work very well on the lung. And CT, as we've discussed, typically you're asked to take a nice deep breath so it can be something that's stationary. So this technology allows the opportunity for something which can be really very fast, very patient-friendly, and give really detailed, rich information about what's actually happening. Where is the air moving throughout the lung? Is there one region of the lung which is diseased, one region of the lung which is not? And so it provides a dynamic, fast method for looking at what's happening in the lung in rich detail.
How does it work?
CT works by imaging something stationary from hundreds and hundreds of different views, and then it puts together different pieces of that puzzle from different views to create a three-dimensional structure. Instead of creating a map of the structure, we want to create a map of the motion. So instead, we measure the motion from different views first. So first we take, say, two pictures of the lung as the lung breathes at one moment and a short moment later. From those two images, we can see how it's moved in two dimensions from one to the other. We do that from three different views, not hundreds, which creates a huge saving in radiation dose. And we put together then a full three-dimensional picture of the motion, not a picture of the lung, but a picture of the lung's motion.
I see, but is it a photographic method of doing it or
it's,
what?
It's, we use X-rays mostly for doing it. So in the same way that CT is based on X-ray as the underlying imaging energy, we also use X-ray to do this. But we've looked at other ways. So, for example, a completely non-X-ray way of doing it using infrared cameras like you find in children's toys.
And what do clinicians say of it, the ones who've actually looked?
So there's the full spectrum. After we spend some time explaining to them what it is and does, overwhelmingly there's been really encouraging support for this. You know, clinicians, by their very nature, have to be conservative so that we can get the standard of care that we expect from them. But there's a real growing level of excitement from the people that we've spoken to about how we can do this. And they welcome something which is functional, but imaging in the lung, which is something that's been lacking for decades.
And can they afford it?
I think fundamentally a big problem in healthcare is the ongoing march of technology, creating newer and better technologies which slightly improve healthcare but dramatically increase the costs. There's something, a real underlying philosophy that we have been driving to. This technology will be cheaper per patient than the existing technologies in the healthcare system.
Well, you know the big problem in Australia. We've got marvellous ideas, we've got incredible equipment that has been shown in prototype, but translating it, getting that final step through entrepreneurs and people who understand businesses and various other, it's been so difficult, and that hasn't put you off?
It's a real challenge, and it's one that we're meeting, you know, with our eyes open and head on. I think one of the difficulties that I see it is that as a lucky country, there are so many opportunities for people with money to enlarge that. You know, in this country, with as lucky and rich as we are, they don't really have to take all that many risks to increase their wealth. So to convince people with large amounts of money to take a risk is a real challenge here in this country. I mean, you've seen it. It's absolutely real, but we're meeting it head on and we're having some traction. Of course, a real possibility is that in the end, we do have to leave these shores. I have to leave my country, take my family, take all our staff and employees and go somewhere else where there's a little bit more money or less aversion to risk. But we're doing absolutely everything we can to keep it here.
Good luck, Andreas.
Thank you very much.
Associate Professor Andreas Forres heads a team at Monash helping clinicians see your lungs when they're not working well. The Science Show on RN. We're giving you two new special words in today's program, both beginning with A. Amplituhedron and now Anthropocene, the human era of our Earth. It took Gaia Vince on a world quest to see what your impact has really been like on the globe and what you're doing to make it lighter. Her book, published this week, is called Adventures in the Anthropocene, A Journey to the Heart of the Planet We Made.
Well, I was the news editor at the journal Nature, and I was working at my desk and receiving every day, every hour almost, reports from scientists and so on, telling me all sorts of amazing and extreme things about the planet. And I was looking out of my window in King's Cross in London, and I thought, what am I doing? Just reading about these places. I want to go there, I want to see what it's really like, because it occurred to me that something quite profound was happening, and at a very short time scale, within the time that I can look back and say 10 years ago it was very different to this in so many places. So I set off, booked a one-way ticket to Kathmandu. I heard of a story that looked quite interesting, a man in the Pun Hills in Nepal, and I thought, well, I'll start there, I'll look him up. So I went on a trek into the hills to find this guy. He was a completely amazing, amazing man who was using home Wi-Fi to connect these very remote villages. Where he lives, the village really did stop at the edge of his mountain. There's no telephone lines, there's no electricity, there's no piped water. This is a remote village, and there are hundreds like that all over the world. And so for these people, the 20th century has barely happened, but this person managed to connect using a home Wi-Fi kit, his village to the next village to the next village, all the way to Kathmandu. Well, once you can do telephone, internet telephone, Skype conversation with someone in Kathmandu, you're connected to the world, because that's the nature of the internet. And that's something really profound that's happening actually in the Anthropocene, is that the village doesn't stop there at the perimeter. The whole world is your village in a way, but in a very profound way. So
it's like bicycles in 19th century Europe.
Exactly. It's very much like that. So if you look at the way that the human gene pool has changed, we have more than half of the world's population now lives in cities. And that's another big, big Anthropocene signal, that people are no longer living in remote places. They're all living in cities, and so they're mingling, the gene pool's mixing. And it's something that was observed when bicycles were brought into Europe, that the villages were merging and the gene pool was changing. It's now happening on a global scale. So a lot of local changes that we've observed over the last 200 years in places like Europe are now happening on a global scale, and that's really changing our planet.
Was the man in Kathmandu surprised to see you?
He was, because he didn't get hold of my email, even though he has internet, for some time. And so it was a bit of a surprise visit, but it went very well.
Going back to your planning of the trip, did you just set off and just improvise place to place to place? Did the journal Nature pay for you, or did you do it on pocket money?
I quit the journal Nature. I left because I wasn't sure how long I was going to be gone. I rented out our house for 6 months, and I paid for my way around as a journalist, writing articles, doing the odd radio piece for the BBC. And it carried on. It went to 1 year, then it went to 2 years. And then after 2 years, 4 months, thought it's really time to go home now. And after that, actually, I carried on doing the odd trip for the book.
Tell me about some other places you went to.
Okay, so I went to another place in the Himalayas, in Ladakh, beautiful Ladakh, a little corner of Kashmir, a very Tibetan corner, where, because of climate change, they're losing the glaciers. And glaciers there are incredibly important because it's actually a high-altitude desert. So they rely on glacier melt during the springtime to irrigate whatever crops they have. So another remarkable human being, and this is a story of so many remarkable individuals, truly amazing, this 70-year-old man who's a former railway engineer who lives up there, has created artificial glaciers, which work. So he makes this kind of depression in the shadow of the mountain, which is fed by winter water, and he slows down the rainwater in various ways using stones and culverts and so on. And then he creates basically an artificial glacier which freezes over during the winter period and melts just at the sowing season. So it's perfect. And he's made a few of these around the mountains and the villagers love him. He's like a rain god. He's pretty amazing.
And you went to Australia as well.
Australia is one of those unique places with incredible natural resources. Most places with amazing mineral resources and so on are still like that because they're very, very poor and they're developing. And the big problem is that because they're very poor and because they don't have the regulatory framework and so on, and often corrupt governments, big companies, other countries are coming in and raping the soil. They're taking away literally the soil in agricultural land grabs, and they're taking the timber, minerals, the oil, and ruining those countries. Whereas the richer countries have got their own framework, they've got very good environmental standards, but Australia's in this unique position where it does still have the resources and yet is destroying them anyway. So it's a tragic story, but it could still turn around. I mean, Australia is very famous for its Great Barrier Reef, and yet the first ecosystem probably to go extinct on our planet will be the coral reefs, because they're being hit by this triple whammy of warmer climate, warmer oceans, acidic oceans, which means they can't keep their algae, which feed them. And by pollution, dredging, Australia is just building a new coal port in a very sensitive area. So, I mean, Australia is very unique in that way.
Any good news? Any good places you came across who are doing it right?
Well, yes, there are. There are plenty. So there are plenty of communities that are learning. I mean, if you look globally, actually, we've never had so many areas under protection, so many areas being conserved. There is an international awareness now that biodiversity is important and people are trying to conserve that. And if you go to a country like Costa Rica, for example, which is poor and yet which has recognised the importance, the monetary value, but also the social value of keeping intact wildlife. It's very encouraging, and lots of places are doing that. Lots of communities are now starting to own their own forests and to make money in a less destructive way. I am optimistic.
So you can actually make a quid and preserve this biodiversity you talk about. It's not one way or the other. You don't have to go sort of back to the Stone Age to look after the nature around you.
Absolutely, absolutely you can. If you look at the Amazon, for example, selective logging is very important. I mean, the Amazon's a really, really interesting example because the government took deforestation very seriously there, because the Amazon's actually on a knife edge. If it loses any more trees due to drought, it could actually tip the entire ecosystem over into a savanna-like desert even. So it's very important not just for the local people and the country, but it's also very important for the planet because it's the lungs of our planet. So, for example, there are different ways of building hydro dams and different ways of exploiting the minerals beneath the forest. And there's some very controversial dams like the Belamonte, for example, which is being proposed there. But there are also some examples of places where they've done it really well. So there's a mine in the middle of the Amazon jungle, but instead of building a road there, and every single road into the Amazon is marked by a halo of 50 kilometers squared of deforestation. So it's really destructive. Roads are some of the most destructive ways of exploiting minerals. So they've actually not built a road. They're using the river to transport out, I think it's oil. It's either oil or gas that they're bringing from there. So actually there's a tiny little pocket in the Amazon which has been deforested for this plant. Very, very small and insignificant, really. And I would say that's an example of how other people could do it, and it costs very little more, but the benefits are huge of not chopping down those trees.
When you went back to the journal Nature and you saw various scientific friends and you told them what you'd put together as a general picture of what human beings are doing with their entire planet, if you like, I know it sounds like almost a cliche, the planet we live on, we're thinking of it for the first time as an entity, What was their reaction, that you were being somewhat hippie-ish or that you were being genuinely scientific in your quest or what?
You know, I think the importance of a first-hand account is that you've got the scientific findings, which are generally from either field trials or from small localised areas, and you're putting that together with people's experience of living on this planet that you're talking about. And I think you get a broader, more holistic view of how we are living. And you were saying that we're looking at the planet differently as this one planet. Well, I think we should also look at our species differently. We're not just a species. We are this big, giant superorganism called humanity, Homo omnis, if you like. And that's the problem. It's not you or I individually changing the atmosphere or using concrete for our house or whatever. It's the fact that so many of us are doing it in such an organized, orchestrated way.
And like a bunch of termites.
Exactly like that. If you watch how termites completely transform a landscape, militarily styled, we're doing the same thing, and we're doing it to the whole planet. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. It really is.
My final question is about really the reception people have, the ones who are not so much educated, who really are hit with this scientific dichotomy. You know, here is the normal way they do things. They want to look after their house. They want to feed the kids. They want to cope with life, which is difficult enough. And then someone turns up and saying, hey, science, take notice. Do you think people are taking notice of science? Do you think they're willing to be receptive about what, after all, is the evidence about the place they live?
I think it's very difficult because on an individual level, you feel that you are very small in this enormous big problem and that what you do to lead your life has very little impact. You know, if I use recycled toilet roll, is it going to change the forests? Or if I use some embossed royal paper, it's going to have no difference. But what we need to do is start thinking as a superorganism. We need to start thinking about how we can transform this being. We're now in the Anthropocene. We're very much living 20th century lives. We're not in the 20th century. We're in a completely changed epoch. It's a fundamental difficulty to get your head around because our agriculture, our cities, our vehicles, everything, our entire energy system is built for a completely different epoch. It's built for the Holocene, for a time of plenty, when we were a less numerous species, when the resources were plentiful, when we didn't have to worry about trashing the oceans because they were a massive, massive big pool of water that we could throw whatever we wanted in. Now we're realizing that that's not true anymore. We're this giant species which is transforming the planet, and we need to recognize that. We need to become more self-aware, and we need to redesign the way we live for this new epoch. We need to think about how we produce energy and food, and it's going to be fundamentally different. It doesn't have to be worse, but it has to be different because it's not sustainable how we're doing it at the moment.
Fortunately, we have the sophisticated political systems to face the challenges and to do what's needed. Gaia Vince's book is called Adventures in the Anthropocene, and it's published this week. She's the former editor of news for the journal Nature. Some of those points Gaia Vince made just now are beautifully illustrated in papers just published in the journal Science. That's of the 6th of June. One is called Humanity's Unsustainable Environmental Footprint, and comes in part from Thomas Weidman at the University of New South Wales. The other paper is on the Amazon and the heroic difference Guy Vince talked about, slowing deforestation through public policy. The ideas, you see, are based on evidence. Next week on The Science Show, the FameLab finals in Cheltenham, our representative and the global winner, and also Dr. Jeremy Leggett and the impact of solar aid. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Robin Williams. And of course, the very good news is that Catalyst is back. First show of this new season, Thursday at 8 p.m. on ABC Television. Lots more science on telly. Catalyst returns.
Hey guys, listen up. Kirsten Drysdale from The Checkout here.
With a once-in-a-lifetime offer.
Did you know that money can buy happiness? That your credit card could help you lose weight? That driving a fancy car raises a man's testosterone?
In a special two-for-one offer,
I'll be joined by consumer psychology expert Dr. Paul Harrison to find out why you buy what you buy and...
bonus deal!
How you can buy better.
To cash in...
catch Talking Shop online anytime from the RN website.